You told me that you had trouble finding this book, Love is Stronger Than Death, by Peter Kreeft, K-R-E-E-F-T. I don't know what to tell you. I bought it last summer at Estes Park doing a relational Christianity conference, and it's a Harper & Row book, so it ought to be available. Last day at the 10:15 lecture, I read something that I've read every year, this letter the 13-year-old boy wrote to his mother, this boy who was dying of cancer. And I want to start today reading this to you because what we got to last day was to look at some of the philosophical, theological positions on death and dying. And what I suggested to you is that Christianity really has a, for lack of a better word, an unusual position on death and dying in terms of the philosophies and the theologies of the world. And I think that because denial is so rampant, and because denial of death takes such subtle forms, for example, it certainly takes a religious form. It takes a medical form. It takes a scientific form, the denial of death, that it's very easy to miss what is utterly unique about the Christian answer, or the Christian position, if you will. It's better for me to say the Christian position, because death is not amenable to an answer. Death is a koan. Death is like a koan. It's like a riddle. It's like a riddle that has to be pondered over. I think of death as a koan. I think of death in terms of what the Scripture says. Seek the truth and you will find it. You will find the truth about death. But it's not the finding that's as important as the seeking. What's hard about death is the seeking. It's the seeking, because it's so awesome and fearful, and therefore the denials are so strong. So death is generally presented in our cultural forms as a stranger, as something apart from me, as something far away from me. And because of that, we don't deal with the depth, the de profundis, the depth that can come from the meeting of death and the meeting of that reality about life, because of the denials. Now, the denials are rampant. The denials hide the fears. And it's the fear of death that is at the basis of the denials. So this boy who was dying, a few months ago, a 13-year-old boy dying of leukemia, wrote a letter to the Cadillac Michigan Evening News. His parents helped him write it, but the thoughts and the fears were his own. Although they were addressed to the doctors and the nurses of the hospital he was in, the message that young Ron Kleinbell left before he died should be taken to heart by all of us. And so he wrote to the doctors and the nurses, "I am a 13-year-old boy, and I am dying. I wrote this to you who are and will become nurses and doctors in the hope that by sharing my feelings with you, you may someday be better able to understand those who share my experience. No one likes to talk about such things. In fact, no one likes to talk about much at all. Doctoring and nursing must be advancing, but I wished it would hurry. The dying person is not yet seen as a person, and this cannot be communicated with, and thus cannot be communicated with as a person. A dying person is a symbol of whatever human fears and whatever human knows. But for me, dying is now, and fear is today. You slip in and out of my room, and you give me medication, and you check my blood pressure. Is it because you're insecure, or just a human being, that I sense your fright? Why are you afraid? I am the one who is dying. I know you feel insecure and you don't know what to say and don't know what to do, but please believe me, if you care, you can't go wrong. This is really what we all search for. We may ask for whys and wherefores, but really don't want answers. So don't run away. All I want to know is that there will be someone to hold my hand when I need it, because I am so afraid. Death may be routine to you, but it is new for me. You may not see me as unique, but I never died before. You whisper about my youth, but when one is dying, is he really so young anymore? I have lots I wish we could talk about. It really would not take much of your time, because you're in here quite a bit anyway. If only we could be honest, both admit our fears and touch one another. If you really care, would you lose so much of your professionalism if you ever cried with me, just person to person? Then it might not be so hard to die in a hospital with friends and relatives close by. That has been witnessed to many more times in our culture. That just says it so well. This little boy dying with the people around him who, to whatever degree, have not dealt with their own dying. And again, the denial of death, out of the fears of death, create this kind of atmosphere that, as I deny it, as I refuse to deal with it in myself, it is not possible for me to deal with it with anyone else. So just in terms of ministering to the dying, it becomes crucial that I have in some way met my own death, met it existentially. You see, because even what I'm doing right now is a form of denial. We are talking about death. That letter can get you a little closer. But basically, this is a lecture about it. And that isn't what it is. What it is something that each one of us have to experience individually and encounter all alone. And not as a collectivity. See, collectivity is another way we deny. It's another form of denial. Our culture is filled with collectivities. We have all kinds of forms of social narcissism, from the almost the paranoia that we get into in our groups, in our churches, in our denominations. That's collective narcissism, where I worship myself in the body that I'm in the group that I'm in. And it's a scandal, really. In Christianity, denominations are a scandal in many ways, because in Christ there is neither male nor female. All is one. And all the denominations, with all the separation that comes from that, and the hatred and the prejudice and the dislike, is an abomination. Is abomination. But you see, the desire to have a group that gives me an identity is a natural desire. Football games. I remember being appalled as a little boy going to Rice Stadium to watch football games. I was a big Rice fan, and I remember walking in the parking lot and seeing this man all bloody. Another man had beat him up. Another man had beat him up in the parking lot. And I remember just the awe in my stomach, I mean, the sense of fear in my stomach, and the lack of the confusion, the not being able to understand why these men would beat each other in the face over a game that they weren't even in. I mean, that was the astonishing thing. They weren't even in the game and seemed to really have no relationship to those two schools. But you see, if my team wins, then I win. If my team is number one, then I'm number one. and whatever frustrations and failures that I feel in my life, for that small moment, I can be somebody. I can be heroic. And so that's the phenomena of social narcissism that happens in groups and in parties and in all of that. And it's probably a necessary part of life, and yet it's one we need to be careful of, because it's a way. See, the group will go on, but I won't. The group will go on. It's a way to try to get sort of a false counterfeit immortality. The other common forms of denial in our culture, pornography of death that Gurr talks about. In our mass entertainment, we see violence. We watch violence. I went to a show the other night, and the movie was called 48 Hours, and there was lots of, you know, funny parts to it, but people were just getting blown up, was shot constantly throughout this movie. I forget how many people got shot. 7 or 8 policemen got it, and friends got it, and they have this graphic stuff where the blood all appears on the chest, and I just thought to myself, this is entertainment. Now there is something crazy about that, even though I was enjoying the heck out of the movie. I'm not trying to be a Lily White here or something. I'm talking about a phenomena that I feel involved in. And if you look at the TV guide, we have the more wholesome TV stories, although they're generally so far-fetched that families, there's no families that are really like that. And so we either have that kind of more maudlin kind of dishonesty, or hospitals, westerns, war stories, detective stories, police stories, and mass entertainment is just full of killing. Killing and death. Death is just, you are saturated with death every night on television, but never once have to deal with, I am gonna die. See, that's the denial. It's a way to deal with death and deny it. I don't have to deal with my personal death. My existential death. I was thinking the other day, why entertainers are so disproportionately paid in this society. I mean, it's unbelievably disproportionate to any value that we know. That people get paid these massive amounts of money for entertainment. Except that there's another kind of denial, which is this externalization. I gotta do something. I can't just be something. I have to go somewhere. Out there is where my happiness is. So let's go to a show. There's nothing to do. Let's go to a show. Let's go out. Let's go be entertained. Let's go watch. I mean, think about that, being a spectator all the time. The passivity of it. The non-creativity of it. Of being a spectator all the time. You just watch and saturate and take in. But you're not an actor in the drama. You're a watcher. We're watchers. We are entertained. We passively become entertained. And run from one of those to the next one of those. I can remember in my drinking days being at parties and trying to get another party organized at the party. You know what I mean? Don't let this party end. Let's get another one organized quickly. So we can have another party tomorrow. It was like, this terrible fear. If that ends, what'll I do? And it was just one party after another. And creating parties and crashing parties and finding parties. I had a tux. I used to go to the River Oaks Country Club constantly to to parties that I wasn't even invited to. Usually the big ones, they just, you know, they didn't even know who they'd invited. I'd pretend like I was one of their dear friends. And it always puts people on the spot, you know, because they can't remember your name. I went to some marvelous parties there, but it was always going to a party and finding another party. And what are we going to do? Now, there's certainly a quality of that in youth, in the teens. I mean, I watch my young daughter and my stepson and stepdaughter and who are in their early 20s, and they just, you know, if they're home in the evening, I know they're going out. It will be about 1 o'clock probably, but they'll be out. And I used to do that too, and I think there's something more typical about it as you're younger. But there is a quality of this kind of relinquishing oneself to externality. Relinquishing this externality. How it looks. Getting the right kind of car. Getting the right kind of neighborhood. Getting the right kind of clothes. Conforming how it looks. And this almost obsessive compulsive activity is a form of denial. Things, you know, Eric Fromm talks about necrophilia, the love of the non-living. Look at the quality of your life and ask yourself, how much life is there? How much am I dealing with living reality? Or do I constantly deal with things? Is my life enamored by the inorganic? Like antiques? Like furniture, like jewelry, like things? And do I just accumulate things? Because I'm going to tell you, one of the things that happens when you start dealing with death is that you have to look at your attachments. The fear of death is directly related to one's attachments. And you see, again, one of the most beautiful things about dealing with death and groping with it and encountering it is that as I deal with my attachments, I can deal with the ways that I stop myself from living life. I can deal with the ways that I'm stuck or the ways that I define myself. See, it's so easy to become identified with things, so that you think that's who you are, and we become enamored by that. So this necrophilia, people who live in the past, you'll hear people, they talk about the past all the time. And I can remember doing that. I can remember in the early days of recovering from alcoholism, I'd keep talking about all I did, you know, all the hell raising and all those nights and telling war stories over and over again. And there was still a fascination for me about being a naughty guy, you know, and raising hell. There was still something I was getting all vitalized by in doing that. And those stories I had a lot of attachment to. I had a lot of attachment to my pain. I had a lot of attachment to suffering. If there is a secret to life, it's to understand, which I don't, but I can talk about it, that the greatest problem that all of us face is the attachment to our suffering. To give up your suffering is an incredible trip. And it's amazing how difficult that is, to give up your suffering. And if people only understood how they define themselves with their suffering. You know, sometimes in therapy, after seeing someone have every opportunity, every modality of possible growth, and then see them a year later, and there they are, still suffering. Still suffering. And I begin to understand how attached they are to their suffering, and that they define themselves with their suffering, that they have no identity apart from their suffering. And I'll talk a lot more about that as we go along, because that is such a powerful thing. There's going to be enough suffering without being attached to it, is my own particular position right now. You know, there's no sense getting attached to it. It'll come. But you see, the things that we're attached to are part of our pain. You can't have pain about something you're not attached to. You can't get upset if you're not attached to it. And that is the great wisdom of the East. It is understood that, although Christian gospel talks about this, when I went in the monastery, we mortified our flesh. Now, they went to some extremes, as far as I'm concerned, but that whole monastic tradition of mortification of the flesh, of denial, to learn how to overcome the attachments to pleasure. And so that you make death to that part of you so that your spirit can soar. And while I don't believe in all the ways they did it, the general idea is that if I'm attached in those ways, then those will be the sources of my pain. Whatever your pain is, that's where your attachments are. And next week I'll give you some exercises that can help you look at what you're attached to. When I spent the days with Jack Swartz this summer in Oregon, the whole conference was on attachment and non-attachment. And it was astonishing to me, the things that I'm attached to, how much I'm attached to them, and how much that defines me and makes my identity. And I don't just mean suffering. I mean, you can be attached to another person in a way that's unhealthy. You can be attached to a child. I'm attached to my own child in some ways that are unhealthy. You know, St. Paul says you have to love and not love. You have to be involved and not be involved. Well, this is tremendously difficult. So, looking at our life, you see where you are with life, the living as opposed to the non-living. Is money more important than people? Are things more important than people? Is the past more important than the present? Are objects more important than subjects? Is it more important than thou? Now I hear it in the words of people. People will talk to me in counseling, and I'll hear them talking about, how are you doing? Oh, it's bad. It's bad. It's bad. See, there's no subject to that. It's really painful these days. For who? For who? You see, if you make everything into an it, then you're not in on it. Have you ever seen those funny little postcards? They put them out in California, and they have things on them like, if you want to be sure of hitting the target, shoot. And whatever you hit, call it the target. Which a lot of folks do, by the way. Or there's another one that says, surprising as it may seem, this is my life. Or I'm going through a difficult transition right now. It's called life. And so the process of being in life and living it to the full, as opposed to withdrawing from it, denying it, or being abstracted in it. It's always it. It's the marriage is not good. The wife. The husband. Who is the husband? Who is the wife? You see how impersonal that is. And we want to get to this I and thou. We want to get to this subjectivity. Me rather than I. I am going to die. I am going to die alone. I am going to die. I am going to die alone. You know, I hope there'll be people around, but they can't die for me. See, it's almost like if I stay in this group, and I think some religions do this, they start to say, you just keep staying in our group and you won't have to die alone. We'll all be there with you. You gonna die too? Nope. They're not gonna die too. See, they may be there with you, but you're gonna die. And I'm gonna die alone, and I have to face that alone. And so that's the issue of dealing with that, of looking at it. And you see, there's a couple of other quick ways we do it. We don't live life now. We live it in the past. That's one way. And by constantly thinking about the past rather than the present. Or couples do this. I see couples keeping themselves from being intimate. Recently, a woman absolutely changed her whole behavior. She absolutely started giving her husband everything that he had been asking for 19 years. I mean, she was ready to make love 7 times a day. She was cooking like she had never cooked before. She was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. She was growing flowers in the just everything the guy had ever asked for. You know what he did with that? He says, "It's a little late, isn't it?" If you could do it now, why couldn't you have done it 18 years ago? I'm not going to respond to this. You see how unconsciously his game is being revealed. He doesn't want to be close to her. He doesn't want any of that stuff he ever said. He thought he wanted that. That's his conscious reason. But his unconscious reason was to stay apart from her. And now the only thing he can do to stay apart from her is to focus on the past and to create conflict in the present so they don't have to be close. Or we women do it if he'd only spend some time at home. So he's got all day Saturday off. And there he is, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, right there all day Saturday. And she says, "What about all the other days that you're not here?" And spends the little time they have telling him how insensitive he is. Now think about that. You know, I'm not disengaging myself from this kind of behavior. That this is a human behavior that is this constant death-like. See, all neurosis is death. There's death all around us. Death is not being created. It's not living. It's not flourishing. It's not loving. It's rigidity. Rigidity. There are some people who try to set the present up so secure that they effectively deprive themselves of any future. Nothing could possibly change. They've got it so rigidly set up. There'll be no excitement, no adventure. There'll be no surprises. Now, I don't want too many surprises. You know, surprise, the house is burned down. You know, I don't want too many surprises. But man, I want some surprises. That's why I like to play those slot machines. You never know. There are very few surprises there, but when they come, they're great. The surprises and people who set their lives up so rigidly that nothing can change. So this is another way to deny life and to choose death. All the things that we know that'll kill us, those are ways of choosing death. Anything you're doing that you know will kill you is choosing death. Now, people don't like to be confronted with that. You are choosing death. You smoke 5 packs a day. You are choosing death. I'm not choosing death. I just like the taste. You are choosing death. That's, you know, you can keep calling it other names. But we are choosing things that will kill us. We don't appreciate our life. Now, the interesting thing is, as you get through the denials and get to the fears, and see death not as a stranger, but as the enemy. See, the fears are death is the enemy. That's much more realistic. You're much more alive when you're fighting your enemy than you are when you're denying, pretending like it doesn't exist. See, neurosis is denial. Anytime people are denying, they're in neurotic behavior. They're avoiding, they're regressing, they're repressing. This is the journal of Andrea, a 17-year-old girl dying of leukemia. She's writing her mother, I didn't even know what it meant to be alive until they told me that I was going to die. At first it meant nothing to me, nothing at all. The word had only a strange, hard ringing to it. Something about platelets and corpuscles and my mother crying, holding the bedpost. She just stood there stunned, holding the bedpost, and my father's head was hanging. I just couldn't imagine not living, not being there with him anymore. It took a lot of days for me to wonder about what it meant then to be really alive and how much I had lived in my 17 years. Then all of a sudden, like a summer rainstorm, I wanted to live very, very much. I wanted to run on the streets. I wanted to taste all the ice cream cones. Quickly, before the summer ran out, I wanted to hug my mother. I wanted to shake my father out of his stupor. Things I had thought of before, some things I had never thought of before, and many things that I had been afraid to do. So, and then if you remember me quoting from Charlie Wurtenberger, the journalist, last year, where he had thought about committing suicide when they told him that he had cancer. And, he decided not to, and he began to write a journal. And shortly, and one of the things he did during the 5 months he was alive is he learned to play the guitar. In fact, he was playing the guitar, singing songs to his kids the night before he died. And he wrote in his journal the night before he died, he wrote about singing to his children, playing his guitar, but he said in his journal, "Hit hard on the proposed suicide attempt. I would have lost the best days of my life." Now see, that's what this little girl is talking about. That until you truly see the frame of death in relation to life, we cannot appreciate life. The mountain to the climber is clearer from the plain. So people who are denying death get into this necrophilia and don't even understand that it's almost like a conspiracy with death. That they are living their life as if they're going to live forever and therefore not living it at all. Putting it off to a rainy day. Afraid to take any risks. Afraid to do any of the things that will be crucial to their living life. So as we come through death as a stranger, the denials, and begin to look at it. And that's what I'm asking you to do, is to look at it, to look at your fears, to really be honest about this, to look at it so you can get to your fears. Some of you may not think you have any fears because you haven't looked at it. You've been denying it for so long because, you see, there's lots of ways to deny it. Scientist stands up and he says, "When you're dead, you're dead." And that's supposed to be a big illumination. Or, it's the termination of biological life as we know it. The scientific answers, they're not answers in terms of any existential quest. They don't give you a meaningful existential answer. I mean, as he explains what happens when life ceases, I'm still sitting there going, "Yeah, but I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it." And as, you know, I remember a friend of my family whose son died at 29, and she's Christian Science, and she's sitting over there mouthing off all these things about, "Well, I know it's okay, death isn't really true," and her body's all broken out in shingles. And I finally got the breakthrough to her. I said, "Okay, look, I'm going to accept that your boy is in Chicago, and he's okay, but you are never going to see him again. Isn't that sad?" And she started crying. That's what's sad about it. I don't care whether there's an afterlife and all of that. At the moment of contemplation of death, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. Think of all the things you give up. You know, what would happen if you died tomorrow? What would be the things you missed? John Jr. and I ate 18 Dunkin' Donuts yesterday. Mother went out of town, and we hooked him to the donut store. A little orgy, a little donut orgy. Said, "How many can I have?" I said, 5 dozen if you want them. He almost freaked out. I think of the things I'd miss doing this. There's nothing more exhilarating than watch you, you're listening to you laugh. And saying something funny and being powerful and being up here and having the possibility of doing this. I'd miss this terribly. I don't want to vie with all those people who have gone before me. There may be better preachers, in heaven. And think of the things that we love in this life that we will miss. Those are the gut existential issues. Last night I was thinking about this, and I was upstairs and John was downstairs, and I was watching my program and he was watching his program, or I was preparing the lecture this morning, reading some stuff, and said I couldn't be down there with him. And see, then I thought about this. I thought about what, you know, if I died tomorrow, what would I lose? I would have lost the chance of going down and rubbing that little old boy's hair and sitting in the other room. I got my lecture prepared sitting in the other room. That's where he wanted me. He wanted me to be close with him. And by thinking about death, by thinking of what's important about life, I began to live life differently. I began to live life differently. But if you're denying and not even thinking about it, you can't even think about that. So therefore, you don't have a frame. You don't have a limit. See, death is a friend. Death is a frame. This is the only life that we know for sure you've got. And you live this life to the full. So that wonderful thing in our town where the little girl, you know, she comes back for her 11th birthday. That's what I was looking for. For that quotation, it's just so powerful. She doesn't anybody live life while they've got it? Anyway, she goes back for her 11th birthday. It's a wonderful quotation. She describes all the things she's going to miss, and it's just a beautiful sort of down to earth sense of what life is about. Now, here's the utterly fantastic thing to me, that as I dealt with denials and as I've dealt with fears of death, I come to an awesome kind of realization, and I wrote this down last night because I want to get this right for you. The fear a dying person is experiencing, the rage, the loneliness, all arise out of constructed images of what he or she imagines it is like to be dead. These constructed images, these fantasies about what it's like to be dead are fantasies. They have to be fantasies since nobody's died and come back and written a treatise on it. Now, we do have these people who have been pronounced medically dead. And I, you know, that I use this material every year, and I will 3 weeks from now when I talk about the afterlife. I think it's a valid witness. But we really don't have any experience of death. So the fears of dying have to be fears that come from the experience of living. The fears of dying are fears that come from the projections out of the experience of living, not the experience of dying. So the fears of dying are the fears of living. And until you get to the fears of dying, you won't really know what your blocks are about living. And you won't know what your fears of living are. So, where do these images come from? Death does not exist in our knowing as an experience. Epistemologically, there is no such thing as death since nobody's ever experienced it. How can you talk about knowing something that you've never experienced? We've experienced dying because we're dying all the time. Kellerman's great book, Living Your Dying, is about all the passages from birth, from the womb to birth to the eight ages. All the developmental stages. Yes, we're dying all the time, but death has never been experienced. So we know nothing about it. How can we be afraid of something we know nothing about? So the fantasies of death only come from our experiences of life. Our projections about death are still part of a living experience. And what I want to underline there is that the fears of death are part of a living experience. So the more I look at the fears of death, the more I can understand that since I know nothing about death, those have to do with the fears of life. and that these two polarities go hand in hand. And if you're denying death out of fear, there's no way to get to this polarity. There's no way to live life to the full. So this dying little girl can tell her mother that she is living now in a way that she's never lived before. She is living now in a way that she's never lived before because of the encounter with death. So what this is all about, what Lent is all about, folks, is the resurrection. It's about life and abundant life. What death is about is life for us. And that's why it's worth doing this material. It's worth giving you this material every year to see how important it is to encounter death for life. That without that encounter, I cannot live my life to the full. So the things that I fear the pain. I fear the separation from my son, from my wife. I fear the being a burden. I fear the unknown. I fear punishment. I fear pain. I fear the process of dying. I fear bedpans and all of that. Every one of those, and I've gone over this with you before when I've run through this list, and you have to do it for yourselves, every one of those fears for me are fears of life. I have feared the unknown out of my insecurity. I was 35 before I took a trip, and my wife had to drag me on it. If someone says, let's go someplace, and I don't know that place, I'll say no almost instantly. There's a way in which I block my own life out of constructed images of the unknown, out of a learned pattern of worry that I learned in my family of origin. You know, how to stop yourself from living life to the full. So to understand that my fear of the unknown is a life fear, why don't I experience it in life and I'll know something more about it for death? Why don't I experience separation in life more? Not good. My relationship with my son still needs a lot of working on. I am still narcissistically involved with him. I'm still tied to him in unhealthy dependencies, and he to me. And I need to work on that. I'm afraid to give him up. I am still getting in touch with my body. I finally quit putting on the water when I go to the bathroom. I mean, I grew up with this body as being rotten. It's rotten. It's the citadel of sin. It's the devil's workshop. So my God, don't let anybody know you're going to the bathroom. Because it's evil and rotten and gross and animal. See, and it's not. It's the body of the Spirit. It's what will become Spirit. It's energy in a grosser, less frequent form. And so as I own my body, as I love it, as I care what I put in it, as I run and have the heart beating, as I occasionally eat donuts and sabotage all of that, still, it's much more of a concern for my body than I've ever had in my whole life. You see, my fear of my body, what happens to my body, has been my fear of my body in my life. My non-familiarity with my body. And I'll be willing to bet you that every fear of death you have is also a fear of life. And that by coming to grips with those fears, you can come to grips with life in a way perhaps hitherto unknown. See, Dag Hammarskjöld once said, you can tell the quality of a person's life by understanding what they believe about death. And if we can understand that all of our beliefs about death are beliefs, until you've gone through and gotten out of the ego into your higher consciousness and encountered the oneness of all things there, you still are constructing ego consciousness belief systems about death. And that's also where the fear comes from. You see, as we begin to understand that everything is one, death and life are one. Death and life are one. All is together. There is nothing separate. then conflict begins to leave us. And separation and the fears of separation begin to leave us. But until we've done that, it's not possible to get there. And you see, also until we begin to understand that therefore there is something unnatural about death. Remember I said that last week? We rage against it. There is something unnatural about it. Every myth, every religion has said the wages of sin is death. There is something unnatural about death. That is not our natural destiny in the sense that we know it. What is that all about? What that's about is to say it isn't the universe that's the villain, it's me that's the villain. In T.S. Eliot's play, The Cocktail Party, Celia says, I should really like to think that there's something wrong with me. Because if there isn't, then there's something wrong with the world. And that is a far more frightening thought. If there's this dirty, fickle finger of fate out there, this dirty, solitary reaper that gets you, and these diseases that get you, like heart attacks, one day your heart rises up and gets you. See, then I am this victim, tossed in the immensity of a hostile life. But if the wages of sin is death, if I've had something to do with death itself, in the deep psyches of people there's a sense of guilt about it, then I can do something about death. And that's what Christianity's saying, just bigger than life. That there is something you can do about it, and there's something you can do to choose your death and choose your life and choose your illnesses and choose your health, and there's a whole lot you can do about it. Now let me just ask you for a second to put everything down and close your eyes. I want to take you on a little meditation. And just start like we've done before, if you will, closing your eyes and focusing on your breathing. And then as you breathe in and out, if you'll see the number one as you breathe out. And the number two. And then the number three. Take it up to 10. When you get to 10, just start over again. With the next number, wherever you are, begin to feel relaxation as you see the number and write it. Starting at your forehead, coming down about 2 inches at a time with each breath that you exhale. Letting go now. Letting go just for a moment of all control. Like your muscles are melting. feel the relaxation. And as you feel the relaxation, let your mind take you to a place of peace, some outdoor place that you know, some experience you've had in your life. And be there now. Look around and see what you see. See what kind of day it is. Feel the air. Smell the smells and hear the sounds. Find some water there, and on the water see a boat coming toward you, approaching you from the distance. In that boat you begin to see the outlines of a figure. You begin to understand that that figure is your death. It's coming toward you. Fight it, just let it come to you. It is a friend. What does it look like? Let it appear to you. Don't try to control it. What is it doing? Ask your death what it wants from you. Ask it where you're going. Ask it something that may be important to you. Hear your death telling you have 6 months to live. And as it tells you, it begins to fade away. Now as you stand there watching your death fade away, bring someone to you. Someone that you want to be with. Let that person come. It may even surprise you. Have them sit beside you. What do you want to say to them? Think of the most meaningful thing in your life and tell that person what it is. The most meaningful thing about your life so far. Make a commitment to come here and dialogue with this loved one in order to decide what you're going to do with your days now. How you're going to live your life, what you're going to do differently. Be willing to come here a few minutes each day and think about that. time you have remaining, how you want to spend that time, what you really want to do. Now just imagine you see the clouds forming the number 3. You know that that's signal to come back. When you're doing this alone, see the 3 become a 2, and see the 2 become a 1. And just slowly, always slowly, open your eyes. And maybe later today you could share this experience with somebody. Somebody that's here with you today or someone else. Talk about it. Become aware of it. And just sit there quietly. I want to read you one other excerpt from Journal of Andrea. This is a 17-year-old girl who was dying of leukemia. She said, "Dear Mother, even as I am dying, I'm living. I know you won't understand that. I know you will still think I'm strange. And now that I look thin and yellow, if you look at me from the outside, I probably look quite ugly to you. But from inside, Mother, I feel beautiful. I feel bigger and bigger every moment, as if I'm going to burst out of this body and enter into another skin. Soon the whole universe will be my body. I'm living more, Mother, as I'm dying each day. I'm growing into something amazing. Wonder if you can understand that."